You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, you might sign kids up to play sports for a lot of reasons. They get to exercise, learn about teamwork, maybe make some friends along the way. But our next guest says youth sports have changed a lot over the last few decades. She's been an athlete, the parent of an athlete, and a coach herself. She says there's less of an emphasis now on fun, a bigger focus on competitiveness, driven in part by the multi-billion dollar youth sports industry and by college sports. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you had an experience in youth sports lately? Has it become too expensive? Has your family been priced out of some sports completely? Are we grown-ups putting too much pressure on kids to compete at a high level instead of having fun and getting exercise? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Linda Flanagan is a freelance journalist, researcher, and former track and cross-country coach. Her new book is Take Back the Game, How Money and Mania Are Ruining Kids' Sports and Why It Matters. Linda, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
In your book, Linda, you highlight a lot of the problems with youth sports. We'll get to those, but in a lot of ways, you really love athletics, at least their potential. Before we get to the negatives, what would a good, positive youth sports culture look like?
Oh, it would look reasonable. It would be involve a supportive coach who looked out for all the kids on the team, was gearing the practices up so that they suited the kids' developmental level. They would be moderate. They would be age appropriate. So you wouldn't have a five-year-old having practices 4 days a week and two games on the weekend. There would be opportunities for growth, development, to learn about teamwork. The coach would, of older kids, would help them understand the application of what they've learned on the team to the rest of their life. So they would learn beyond, the X's and O's of a game. I mean, there's all kinds of wonderful things you can learn from sports, and I'm a big believer in what they can do for you, and I've benefited so much myself. It's just that they've changed so much that we've lost a lot of that.
Let's get into some of those changes. One of them I mentioned is the money. Can you talk about just how much that has exploded as an industry?
Yes, it's really kind of shocking that it is a $19 billion industry. That's B, billion. And to put it in context, the NFL is a $15 billion industry, and it has just taken off. Since 2010, it has grown 90%. And, you know, the long and short of it is there's a lot of people profiting off your family.
Now, a big part of the problem is, and I'll admit, I'm a sports parent myself. I wasn't the worst one out there, but there are things I wish I had done differently. What is driving parents to define ourselves in a way by what our kids do out there on some sort of athletic field?
You know, it's such an interesting question, and it really does go beyond athletics, but sports are so popular. They're the most popular extracurricular activity that's where we see it the most. But there's been a change in the perspective, adult perspective on childhood, and a new understanding of what we parents think we owe our kids. As the great journalist Jennifer Senior put it, she said, "Children have moved from our employees to our bosses." And I think that really, that hits home and really resonates, because it can sometimes feel like our kids' schedules and lives are the deciding factor of what the family does. And this is more so than in the past, that parents derive status from their offspring. And I explain more about how that happened in my book.
Are kids still having fun out there, or have we grown-ups in a lot of ways sucked the fun out of the games?
Well, I mean, of course, that's one of the giant problems is that, everyone says this, everyone I spoke to, and I talked to so many people about youth sports and what's changed and where they're headed. And, one of the common themes is that they're just not fun anymore. They're serious. You see third graders with their uniforms and they're tucked in, and there's an official walking by to make sure they have regulation socks on. And it's just become more about adults and, commercialism than it is about, the kids' enjoyment. And, that's a real loss, because some of the kids will quit and never really develop athletically.
Talking to Linda Flanagan about her new book, Take Back the Game, How Money and Mania Are Ruining Kids' Sports and Why It Matters. You can join in with your experiences as a youth athlete now or in the past, as a parent thereof, a coach, a ref. What are you seeing? What do you wish could change about the game, whichever game it is? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Linda, before we go to our callers, I want to go to another piece of the puzzle that looms over everything: college sports. How have changes in college sports driven what we're seeing at younger and younger ages?
Well, you know, it's not just changes in at sports in colleges and universities. It's also about just broader changes at those institutions overall. I mean, for one, they cost a fortune. Everyone knows that tuition costs are staggeringly high. It's $44,000 a year is the average cost for a national private university. It's $12,000 for a state university. I mean, these are just giant expenses. And on top of that, the perception is that it is much harder for kids to get in. And there's a lot of data to back that up. So there's a lot of insecurity about where kids are going to go. And parents worry that they're not going to be able to go to the same level school that perhaps they went to. And then you have sports. And they seem to offer not exactly a shortcut, but another way in. Because sports, they generally offer more athletes in who have somewhat lower academic standards. There's a streamlined recruiting process. And of course, there's $3.6 billion in scholarship money, athletic scholarship money that, you know, can be dangled before parents to make it seem like, well, this might be the way in.
And that gets to this incentive structure, I think, for parents. Well, if I hold off on my kids starting whatever sport it is until fourth grade, and all those other kids are already in since kindergarten, are they behind? Are they going to be able to keep up? Are they going to compete for that college admission or maybe that D1 scholarship, or however much of a long shot that might be? It's an arms race, right?
Yes. I mean, I really wish someone, and maybe I'll do this one day, would figure out what the investment would be if parents took the money they put into their kids' sports and put it into, you know, an index fund or something, and over 10 years and saw what that ballooned to versus what they're going to get out on the other end of it. Because, you know, 2% of high school athletes, first of all, only 6% of high school athletes even play sports in college. Only 2% get any kind of scholarship money at all. You know, if that's why you're doing it, it's really playing the lottery.
You're worried about the kids mainly, but you also talk about the stress that the travel, the time, the money puts on parents and families. Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, I mean, I really think it's kind of an underappreciated problem how much sports have kind of taken over family life. It's like it's kind of an alternate universe for those families that are involved in it, where, you know, if it's there's a two-parent household, there's a lot of dividing and conquering. One parent drives the son to Virginia for a lacrosse tournament, and the mother drives the daughter to Connecticut for a soccer tournament. There's just a lot of disruption in families, and also for siblings who, you know, somehow are either dragged along or expected to follow along. It's not all good by any means, and it's hard. It can be hard on marriages. We have little data on that. But if you ask around, you can see that there's no way it can't have an effect on marriages and on family finances.
We're talking to Linda Flanagan, journalist, former track and cross-country coach, with us today to talk about her new book. It's called Take Back the Game, How Money and Mania Are Ruining Kids' Sports and Why It Matters. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about you? Are you one of these families that's gone all in on youth sports? Did it creep up on you? Did you find yourself spending more money, more time on sports? If you are a youth yourself, if you're into sports, do you feel a lot of pressure, or are you able to have fun doing it? And how about the atmosphere at kids' games? A lot of people yelling at the referees, arguing with the coaches, overcoaching from the parent sidelines. What are you seeing? How can we fix it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Linda Flanagan about her new book. It's Take Back the Game, How Money and Mania Are Ruining Kids' Sports and Why It Matters. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions, your own experience with youth sports as a parent, a family member, a coach, a referee, maybe a young person yourself. Do you see problems? What still makes it worthwhile if you think it is? Are there changes you'd like to see, whether it's behavior of parents on the sidelines or bigger changes in the whole system? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We heard from Kathy in Deerfield, who says her kids are grown. They raised them back in the 80s now. And back then when they were in club sports, Kathy says they were upset. The coaches at club sports are upset that the kids took the summer off and that the kids played multiple sports. So this has been around for a while. Linda, this is a story you've run into a lot. Why are you playing another sport? Yes. Why are you taking time off of our sport and things like that?
Yes, yes. And that's only gotten worse. I mean, it's even just over the last decade, you know, clubs and private teams are expecting athletes to not only play during the summer, but, you know, by the way, play what would traditionally be considered a spring sport in the fall and the winter, too. There's just more heaped on kids and their families, more expectations. And it's very hard to resist. So, you know, kudos to the mom who did, because it's hard to resist that kind of pressure.
Thanks for that call, Kathy. Another consequence we haven't gotten into that you're right about, Linda, is risk of injuries, often, especially if we overdo just one sport. What are you seeing there?
Yeah, I mean, the medical people I spoke to, the sports doctors, the common word they used was epidemic. They said there's an epidemic of overuse injuries. And I should add, overuse injuries are completely preventable. They're just from using, various parts of the body too much for too long. It's repetitive use. There is an epidemic of overuse injuries. And in Tommy John surgery, we all know about that. I spoke to an orthopedic doctor who said he's been performing this surgery on 12-year-olds. There are more stress fractures, growth plate injuries, injuries to knees and tendons. You know, for young women, there's the female athlete triad. These sort of what you could consider chronic or kind of debilitating injuries, like overuse injuries. And then there are also the more catastrophic ones like ACL tears, which have become an enormous problem. They're devastating injuries that to the knee, and it puts kids on the sidelines for 6 to 12 months and gets them out of their sport. And what I found, I was shocked to discover that doctors are saying that half of the people who tear their ACLs will have arthritis in that knee in 10 years. You know, and in my community, it seems like every other week I'm hearing about usually a girl, often a middle school girl, another girl on the team, on the lacrosse team, tore her ACL. Well, if that girl is 12 or 13, she could be hobbling around, at 23 with arthritis. So it's not just a short term. It's not just, this season you're on the sidelines. It can have, longer term consequences down the road.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Jesse is with us in Madison. Jesse, hello. Jesse, your connection is not great. Jesse told our call screener he's been coaching for 17 years, seen a transition of kids sports into almost semi-pro. Parents are praying their kids go pro, and parents give them lots of instructions on where and when to play their kid. Do you hear this a lot from coaches, Linda?
Oh God. I mean, that's so typical. It's just, the parents have become like agents on the sidelines to some extent. And it is just very counter to what youth sports are supposed to be for, which is children's development and appreciation for sports. A vanishingly small number of kids are going to go on to play professionally. It's, this idea that somehow if the parent yells the right instruction on the sideline, it's going to make the difference. is simply wrong, and it is not helpful to either the child or the coach.
Thanks for calling in, Jesse. Sorry we lost you there at 800-642-1234. Talk to Linda Flanagan about youth sports. Her book is called Take Back the Game, How Money and Mania Are Ruining Kids' Sports and Why It Matters. Still time for you to share your story, your question, maybe your solutions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Linda, let's talk about some of your solutions. One big one that I guess, you even suggest we won't hold our breath on is getting rid of college sports as we know it, going to club and intramural sports. As a thought exercise, what would that look like? How would it help?
Well, I mean, just imagine for a minute if college sports were run the way high school sports are, so that kids, you know, if they wanted to join the football team or the tennis team, they tried out at the start of this season. They arrive on campus and then they decide they're going to try out for the team and the coach picks them. I mean, it's so alien to the way it's done now with this giant and expensive recruiting process. But if you had tryouts, say, but you still had intramural sports and you had club sports, so kids could still play, the incentive structure for the club teams and the privatization of youth sports and commercialization of it would evaporate, because much of what drives some of the nonsense is this hope that kids will be recruited and perhaps they'll get into a better college. That would eliminate the problem. But again, I'm not holding my breath. It's not going to happen.
Let's bring on another caller now. Reed is with us in Whitewater. Reed, hello.
Hello.
What did you want to ask about?
I was curious your thoughts about the mental health issues that also come with very competitive sports at a young age. When I was playing soccer competitively, it was just destructive to have coaches and parents just rail on other kids / yell at kids who are 12, 11, 10, and just tell you, you know, you suck. You have to go join another team. You're kicked off the team, whatnot.
Reed, thanks for the call. Linda, again, probably more common than we'd like, the mental health impact.
I mean, it's just so terrible. And I it still shocks me that we kind of allow this, that, you know, we have this carve out for atrocious behavior in sports that we just would never dream of allowing in the classroom or the workplace. And I think, you know, we are seeing more attention being paid to this at the college level, because we've had some, you know, some terrible suicides over the past year or so. And it's called attention to the fact that, you know, it's certainly at the college level, there's so enormous amount of pressure and stress and sleep deprivation that goes on. And it's just, that is kind of trickling down, certainly to high school too, where kids feel a ton of pressure. And, you know, I want to add, some kids can take it. Some kids love it. They thrive on that competitiveness. But, you know, a good portion, it's too much for them.
Thanks for that call, Reed. You've got a lot of solutions in the book, Linda, for parents and families. I want to look at the community level for a moment. You highlight some communities that have rethought how they approach youth sports. What are some of the best lessons we could do at that level?
Well, I think if you look at, say, the high school, there's a high school I profile, Tuscarora High School in Maryland, that has shifted the way it views sports, in that it's not just all after school. They do intramural and they have intramural classes, sports during the day. They offer a lot of club programs. They offer programs for kids with disabilities, physical and intellectual. And their purpose is inclusion. And, you know, it is just it's a healthier environment. 53% of the kids at that school participate in sports. And, you know, there are ways to kind of shift it from this ultra serious, win at all costs, you know, short-term success that is the kind of defines youth sports now.
And that raises a really big point here, Linda. One consequence of all of this doesn't have anything to do with the kids who are in these high-pressure sports environments. We have lots and lots of kids who don't get much exercise, who aren't involved in these group activities. How do we make sure we get them out there too?
I know. Well, that's one of the terrible consequences of this commercialization, is that you know, so many kids are just edged out of sports. It's like entirely participation in sports is essentially class-based. And, you know, some people in leadership positions are striving to correct that. I profile in the book a woman named Monica Wallace, who's a council member in New York State. And she lobbied when Governor Cuomo introduced legislation to allow for mobile sports betting. She lobbied to include a provision that would carve out $5 million every year to go to low-income areas where children are denied or don't have access to sports. So that there are, you know, around the edges, there are efforts being made to where among, you know, leaders and people who have some authority who can address this to repair it on the margins. And, you know, that's just one state. I believe other states have taken similar steps.
Linda, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Linda Flanagan. She's a freelance journalist, researcher, and former track and cross-country coach. She was with us today to talk about her new book. It's called Take Back the Game, How Money and Mania Are Ruining Kids' Sports and Why It Matters. There is still time for you to share your experiences, negative or positive. If you were involved in a team, a community that you think got things right, love to hear about that. Post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Again, look for the Ideas Network Facebook page. You can also email us, ideas@WPR.org, to share your experiences in youth sports, for better or for worse. First, gun violence is a big public health problem in the United States, and it's gotten worse in the last couple of years. Gun violence generally, mass shootings specifically, have been on the rise. 2022 is no exception. There have been over 300 mass shootings this year so far, using one common definition, averaging more than one a day. Our next guest is a violence epidemiologist. Violence epidemiologists look at the problem of gun violence in the same way they might look at contagious diseases, as a society-wide problem that can take many layers of prevention to solve. She says even though there's not one magic solution, a combination of ideas can make a big difference. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about how we can research and find out what's likely to cause gun violence? Do you think we need a better understanding as a nation about the risk factors, what to do about them? Is there something maybe in your own community, a program, a law, something else that you think helps make violence less likely? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Caitlin Jedalina is an epidemiologist and publisher of the newsletter Your Local Epidemiologist. Caitlin, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I think a lot of times we might think of a gun violence, a homicide, suicide as, I guess, gun problems or crime problems. What do we learn when we look at it as a public health problem?
Yeah, it is a very much a public health problem, not only physical, so injuries or death, but also mental as well. And the impact, for example, mass shootings has on a community and on perceived safety in schools, for example. And so as a violence epidemiologist, we try and look at how, for example, guns and gun violence impact not only that immediate safety and health, but also the health of our long term and how we can better have a quality of life.
One tricky thing is that, you know, with a lot of diseases, a lot of money might go into researching the causes, the spread, prevention, treatment, things like that. You've written lately that that really came to a halt in the United States, at least in the federal level, when it came to funding of gun violence research. What happened?
Yeah, that's right. So this lack of funding really started back in 1993. There was this famous study published in the New England Journal of Medicine that found that having a gun in the home increased the risk of homicide in the home, which I don't think anyone is too surprised about. But this really set off a political domino effect. And essentially, we got this thing called the Dickey Amendment, which was inserted into the CDC spending bill by Congress, which basically said that no funds could be made available to injury prevention and control used to advocate or promote gun control. And the language was very unclear, but really no federal employer researcher was willing to risk his or her career or the agency's funding to find out. So what happened was that that research money essentially dried up very quickly. And this set gun violence research back decades. And that's because our research is mainly funded by this federal money. So we couldn't conduct any of these large population-based studies. Fortunately, this didn't stop nonprofit foundations from funding this research. Also, fortunately, just recently in 2020, for the first time in 25 years, our federal budget included about $25 million for the CDC and NIH to research gun-related deaths and injuries. And I will say this seems like a lot of money. $25 million would be great to have in my bank account, for example, but it's not enough to reflect the public health crisis. There was a study in 2017 that estimated we need about $1.4 billion to curb the gun violence epidemic.
Now, you've written and others have about a Swiss cheese model of public health. We've heard about it some with COVID-19 prevention. First of all, what do we mean when we talk about a Swiss cheese model?
Yeah, I think we're all familiar with the Swiss cheese approach to COVID-19. Basically, the overarching theme is that no solution, one solution is perfect, right? So when we're talking about COVID-19, a vaccine isn't going to just be the magic silver bullet. Masks aren't going to be the magic silver bullet. Ventilation and filtration. I mean, it takes all of these layers to really stop the virus and to protect ourselves. And so, yeah, a few weeks ago, I adapted the Swiss cheese approach to be applied to gun violence. And the overarching theme is that no solution is perfect, but we can add enough layers to slow down or eventually block the opportunity for disease. And in this case, it's firearm deaths. And I think this, it's important to recognize that this needs to be executed not just at this individual level responsibility, just like it's individual level responsibility to get your vaccine, but also community and policy level responsibility.
Let's look at some of the different elements of this model. The one you write about first is safe storage. And this is one that individuals can do with firearms, but you also hope to see campaigns to encourage safe storage of firearms. Can you talk about what you're hoping for and the impact it might have?
Yeah, that's right. I think it's one of the lower hanging fruits in an individual level approach is to have a gun safety and gun safe gun storage. About 42% of homes have at least one firearm. And unfortunately, a lot of kids, if we're looking at that kid perspective, live with unlocked loaded guns. And so I think that this is, you know, firearm owners need to focus on safe storage and understand risk factors that can lead to crises. I also think that firearm owners can be our leaders in this and help change cultural norms around what is safe and responsible for firearm ownership. And really engage with those voices, as well as I think there's a responsibility, even if you're not a firearm owner. For example, if you're a parent, there's a 1 in 3 chance your kid is going to a friend's house with firearms. So just like you'd ask about pets or allergies or supervision before the kid enters the home, you can also normalize a question as asking if there's an unlocked gun in their house as well.
We are talking to Caitlin Jedalina, an epidemiologist who focuses on violence, also publisher of the newsletter, Your Local Epidemiologist, saying there's a lot of little things we can do to help prevent gun violence, gun fatalities. Add them up and they can make a big difference. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions for our guest, changes you'd like to see made. Do you want to see more, for example, federal funding of public health when it comes to the impact of firearms? Do you want to see more encouragement of gun locks at home, gun safes? Have you adopted that yourself? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Another personal responsibility you're hoping to encourage is building relationships and helping mentor children, I guess, to help prevent them from committing acts of violence in the future.
Yeah, and I think this is really focused on, I mean, there's all types of different gun violence, but when we're looking at particularly mass shootings, one of the main predictors is isolation, or these long-term frustrations coupled with lack of support. And this can be devastating to not only the child or the mass shooter, but also obviously the community. And so I really think that we need to create these healthy, honest, really long-term relationship with kids in the community. And so that means we can volunteer as mentors at after-school programs like the Boys and Girls Club. And so this is getting not directly at the gun violence, but really those constellations of causes underneath the surface that can prevent downstream effects.
And you raise a good point that I'd meant to bring up earlier. When we're talking about the impact of firearms, we could be talking about suicide. We could be talking about domestic violence. We could be talking about mass shootings, gang violence, whatever. There are a lot of different kinds of gun impacts, and we might need different solutions for the different ones. It might not be one size fits all. Can you talk about that a little more?
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, a lot of our attention and the most media attention is on mass shootings compared to any other firearm injuries. Mass shootings are incredibly tragic, and they have far-reaching impacts on the community, mental health, and even our perceptions of safety. But compared to other firearm injuries in the United States, they're incredibly rare. The most firearm injuries are suicides in the United States, followed by homicides. About 1% of firearm injuries is attributed to mass shootings. And so I think that perspective is really important when we want to look at what we are trying to prevent, what we are trying to move the dial on, because the intervention and that prevention strategy is going to be very important, depending on what type of violence we are trying to stop.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Josh is with us in Sparta. Josh, hi.
Hi, how are you guys doing today?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Josh?
I wanted to bring up an asset that's very underused, and that's hunter education. Hunter education doesn't, you know, we target children typically who want to go out hunting.
We lost you, Josh, but I think we take the point, Caitlin. Hunter education, training kids to respect firearms, helping avoid mishandling of firearms, of course, is part of that. What do you think?
I think it's a great idea. It's actually something that we've been doing in my own research, is leveraging firearm ranges and firearm retailers to help educate at point of sale, especially first-time firearm owners. Because a lot of that education, at least where I was in Texas, isn't necessarily disseminated very widely or broadly. And particularly when we're talking about kids, I think this is very important, because the most unintentional firearm deaths are among kids, and that's because they are genuinely curious. When they find a firearm, for example, at the side of the bed, and they look down the barrel, they maybe point it at another kid, and then it accidentally goes off. And so I think that if we take that curiosity away, and if we know there is going to be a firearm in the household, to really educate safe handling, and that may help reduce at least the unintentional firearm deaths at a very young age.
Josh, thanks for that call. We're talking to Caitlin Jedalina, epidemiologist, publisher of the newsletter Your Local Epidemiologist. She says we can apply a public health model to find solutions, lots of solutions for gun violence. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for our guest about using epidemiology and public health to research violence prevention? Are there things that you think would make different types of gun violence less likely, a combination of things? Do you see efforts in your own community? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. The conversation continues coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about gun violence prevention. Caitlin Jedalina is with us, epidemiologist, publisher of the newsletter, Your Local Epidemiologist. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions for our guest, your thoughts on what might help bring down the number of gun injuries and fatalities in your community, in the nation as a whole. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. Steve is with us in Phillips. Steve, hi.
Hello. I wanted to share that I'm a lifelong hunter, shooter, gun collector. But one thing that I've done is in too many advertisers, magazines, TV shows, kind of sensationalized, glamorized killing, or gun magazines, you know, glamorize concealed carry. So I've tweeted big vendors, talked to magazine editors, publication editors, and commented on that. And I think that, you know, that's one thing as consumers we can do is say, not everybody is into sensationalizing killing and making, you know, glamorizing concealed carry. We can get their attention through economics.
Steve, I want to ask, have you heard back from any of the people you've written to or communicated with?
I have. One editor, I actually canceled my subscription to an outdoor magazine that's published in Wisconsin. You know, I explained my concern. He really didn't get it. He called and said, I hate to lose a subscriber. And I said, you know, I'm sorry. I just I don't want to see this kind of stuff anymore. I'm out.
Steve, thanks a lot for calling in. Caitlin, what do you think about Steve's story?
Yeah, you know, I'm disappointed to hear that. But I think it's absolutely true that we really need to leverage gun owners to help figure out ways to make gun violence, reduce gun violence in our communities. I don't think that we are leveraging that stakeholder perspective enough at all. I think the other thing that was brought up was this sensationalism, and we really need to be cognizant, especially in the media, when we cover, for example, perpetrators of mass shootings. There was one study that I remember that looked at mass shooters versus professional athletes and film stars. And they found that mass killers received more coverage than professional athletes and television stars. And so we really need to work on this as a community as well and to be cognizant of this bias as well.
Steve, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Caitlin Jedalina, epidemiologist, looking at ways to a lot of different ways to help reduce the risk of gun injury and fatality in the United States. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Dan joins us now in Franksville. Dan, hello.
Yeah, if it saves one life, it'll be worthwhile. Just simple things like she's talking about is a good thing, but the culture we live in is based on violence. I mean, our country goes to war just nonstop. The last 20 years, we've been in like 100 different conflicts that people never even heard of around the world. And, you know, then the parents get into the stuff because they get into the politics, and then their kids are listening to them, you know, well, get the Muslims or get this. You know, a lot of people that go to our school systems are not that educated, where they don't spend money on education. They're not that educated, so that's a tall order.
Dan, thanks for the call. Caitlin, Dan worried. I think that maybe we glorify war and violence in general in this country. Are there, whether it's that exactly, are there cultural changes that you think you'd like to see?
You know, guns are certainly a part of our culture. There's no doubt about that. And that's why I just don't think it is feasible to say, let's just take away all 330 million guns in the United States. Like that's not going to happen, like they did, for example, in New Zealand or Australia. I will say, though, that there are other countries that are in a lot of conflict as well, and they don't have these problems either. And so a lot of this has to do with access to these guns. And I think that if you want to change that access, it's going to take policy level. Who is getting these guns and why? And how can we change that on a systematic level? It is truly, I think, one of the ways to really move the dial here in the United States.
Thanks for the call, Dan. You mentioned earlier, Caitlin, that the number one cause of gun fatalities in the United States is suicide. Are there efforts you'd like to see to tackle that in particular?
You know, there's a lot of we're working on in the suicide realm with specifically with guns, for example, having smart locks. A lot of research is focusing on that, for example, using a fingerprint, for example, to unlock your gun, I think is very innovative approach. I also think that it's that gun access, but we also have a mental health issue in the United States, which is a whole different epidemic we could talk about another 30 minutes about. But we really need to find solutions for people. We really need to get people help if they want it. And guns touches part of that, but not necessarily all of it.
A lot of conversations about firearms in the United States. It's no secret our side versus your side, whichever side you're on, gun control versus gun rights. It seems like you in your work really try to bridge that, to work with gun owners and non-gun owners. How important is that to finding some of these solutions?
Yeah, you know, I think it's actually one of the biggest problems we have in the United States. Take any topic right now, that we are so polarized and do not see the other perspective. And I think that the solution to almost all of these problems we have right now are somewhere in between by us holding out our arms and working together. I understand that everyone's incredibly frustrated. People are traumatized by events, and I get that. But if we want any sort of movement, we need to work together, just like we did with the tobacco industry, just like we did with seatbelts and cars. We can overcome gun violence in the United States. It's going to take time. It's going to take a lot of effort, but it's going to take all of us putting our heads together and having this multidisciplinary approach.
Briefly, as we wrap up, we heard it from Michael via email. He says, it seems like with an epidemic, the answer is frequently to allocate a lot of resources. But with gun violence, Michael writes, there doesn't seem to be the same recognition of gun violence as an epidemic or pandemic. As we wrap up briefly, do you see people starting to recognize and think about gun violence in that way?
I certainly do, but I also know I have a biased perspective. I surround myself all the time with this. But I do think that it's starting to finally gain some sort of attention, and as it should. This is a major problem in the United States. Firearms is the number one cause of death among kids. That is tragic, and we need to find ways to prevent this. And like I said, this is going to take time. It's going to take a lot of conversations, a lot of tough conversations, but it will happen. I just hope I can do all I can to help move that dial in the next coming years.
Caitlin, thanks again for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Caitlin Jedalina is an epidemiologist, publisher of the newsletter Your Local Epidemiologist. She talked to us about applying methods of disease prevention and public health to gun violence.